Serving veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler. Brought to you by this local station and its sponsors. And presented everywhere on the air and online by Paul Everett's RV Country. With 8 locations in 5 western states.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. You know, if you're from Denver, Colorado, our guest today, Sam Tarasaki, may have filled a prescription for you once upon a time. But first, he had to survive World War II as a 20-year-old mortar man in Italy with his fellow Nisei soldiers of the 442nd Regimental Combat Team.
You described for us April 5th, 45, your first day in combat. And people know that the war in Europe lasted another month beyond that. After experiencing that, seeing guys coming by with legs blown off, knowing that grenade landed so close that if the rock's not there, you're not there. How did you sleep that night? How did you cope with that on a daily basis moving forward?
I don't know. Those things you don't, at least I don't remember. I know we moved forward, had to crawl through a minefield that the scouts had marked where the mines were, the same minefield that blew these guys' ankles off. Marked it with toilet paper, which we always carried. Take a sheet of toilet paper and put a little clot of dirt on it, and you knew it was safe to step there.
Well, that was my question. Did you know it was safe, or you just knew some weren't safe? It doesn't mean there aren't necessarily more out there that nobody found yet,
there
right?
There were more out there, but it just scared as hell and went ahead step by step, hoping that you didn't step on a mine that wasn't marked. We got through there and kept pushing the Germans back town to town from where we initially attacked to these little coastal towns, Massa, Carrara, where the famous marble quarry is, La Spezia, where the Italians had a naval base, Genoa.
And you're leading a mortar squad that entire time?
Yeah, carrying a mortar.
When you're firing that mortar, how frequent are those rounds, or what is that process like when you're in a position where...
Well, every time we would stop in a position, we'd set up our mortar and just wait for orders from the front, from the guys ahead of us.
You had a forward observer who's given you coordinates for a target?
Exactly. I know one time we set up our mortar in the marble quarry in Carrara, shooting straight, almost straight up over the marble mountain to positions that they thought they were in. I don't remember exact location was, but another time we set up our mortar and they called for some rounds, so we sent a couple of rounds over the mountain. And, you know, being a mortar man, you don't know whether...
You never see what you're hitting.
That's right. The only thing... On that particular time when we moved forward, we saw a bunch of bloody bandages and stuff like that. But we don't know whether...
You don't know if it's from you or...
No.
Well, and correct me if I'm wrong, but if you're firing a mortar, they start to figure out where those shells are coming from, right? And then you're probably taking some incoming also?
Oh, yeah. That was the thing that they worried the most. The artillery, you could hear it coming. Mortar rounds, you didn't hear it until it was just before it exploded. You hear a squish, and a shh, bang. Whereas a German 88, you'd hear shoo, and then it would explode.
So how close did German mortar rounds come to your position?
We were leaving a fort in North Italy, spent the night in the fort, old fort, ancient fort that had a moat around it, bars on the windows. When we left there, we were shelled that night, but the artillery shells hit the wall, so all it did is kind of knock the breath out of us, but it didn't penetrate the walls because they were so thick. But when we pushed out of there, we followed this stone wall that bordered the roadside. Just then, a mortar attack happened. Turns out that one of our jeeps was just coming back, and I think he must have been a forward observer or something from ahead of us. For some reason, he stopped there. There's a wall in between us and where the jeep was and where we were resting, and mortar shells came down. Next thing you know, the guy's laying on the ground. One of our guys is laying on the ground on the road, hollering, "Medics, medics." So I think it was Mike and myself jumped over the wall and went over there and put a bandage on his calf. He was had a bad slash, a shrapnel slash on his calf. We all carried this first aid thing. It's a pad where you put it on there and then tie it as tight as you can. Compress is what it was. That's closest I came to a mortar attack, I think. On the 5th of April, I don't think we were exposed to as many mortar attacks as we were to artillery and to grenades, rifle grenades.
And you told us about the one, the grenade that landed on the other side of the rock.
Yeah.
Were there other situations that you look back on now and say, hey, that was pretty close?
Oh, I guess in one town, as we pushed forward in Italy, in one town, we were getting shelled. Fortunately, one of the shells didn't hit us, but hit the house down the road from us. And I think it was some B Company guys got killed then. I jumped in a haystack. The Italian farmhouses had their animals on the first floor and their living quarters on the second floor. This is on the first floor. Jumped in the haystack, not realizing the place was full of fleas. I fought the fleas for the next 2 months.
Regretted that decision?
Well, I itched a lot, scratched a lot.
I guess it would be worth it if being in the haystack saved your life.
That's right. You know, as a infantryman or mortarman, you don't get the latest news. In fact, some of the old-timers knew that the war was going to end then. We never knew that.
When did you figure it out, and what did it mean to you?
Didn't believe it. We were in a town northern Italy after we had captured a number of Germans and had them on the run. I was in a town, spent a miserable night in this town square, rained all night, woke up in the morning and all kinds of Italians running around said the war is over. I didn't believe them. Shortly after that, an observation plane flew over and dumped the bundles of the Stars and Stripes and said the war is over. That's when I knew.
How big of a relief was that?
Oh, you don't. I remember none of the guys jumped up and down or anything. It just kind of took it as a matter of fact. We were happy that it was over, and it was a day or two later we had a memorial service at an abandoned warehouse. Our chaplain delivered a sermon and read the names of all the guys in the 100th from the first one that was killed down in Salerno. Very sad. Couldn't help from crying.
I believe it, and I'm sure, even though, as you're telling it, there was only about a month that you spent in real intense combat, that had to be the longest month of your life, right?
Yeah, I think so.
And sure, there had to be days in there where you thought your name could have been one of those that chaplains read.
Well, I may wondered why I'd survived and the others didn't.
Did you have days where you thought that was going to be it? Did
you? Oh, sure, yeah. Pray to God. Pray to God when we're under artillery fire that the next one wouldn't come over and hit us.
It's got to be a pretty helpless feeling.
It is. What do? Put your hands over your head and hug the ground as much as you can and hope that you don't get hit. I know I recited the Lord's Prayer all the time.
I'm just imagining being in those shoes and how lonely and scary and just difficult that must have been.
It was. It was scary. When your legs start shaking, you can't stop it from shaking. That's when I knew I was scared.
And you mentioned that memorial service while you're still there in Italy and the war has just ended and they're reading off name after Japanese surname. Some of those guys are probably guys you knew?
Yeah.
And you told them, you're crying.
Yeah.
How should we today remember those guys whose names you heard read that day?
Well, I don't know. I just live a good life. Pay them back by living a good life and being tolerant. You know, when I joined the outfit, from the old-timers, I heard maybe three or four names of guys that they all looked up to. One of them, who was our chaplain, Israel Yost, Pennsylvania Dutch chaplain that never knew what an American of Japanese ancestry was. In fact, he was given the option of not being in the 100th Battalion if he didn't want to be. I told him that this is made up of all Japanese Americans, and you don't have to be part of it if you don't want to. And he says, no, it makes no difference to him. He wanted to be a combat chaplain, and that's what he did. So he was one of the guys that all of the old-timers used to talk about, because he wasn't a chaplain that stayed in the back. He was a chaplain right up there with the medics, retrieving bodies, giving the last rites, things like that. Two more. Fukuda ended up as battalion commander in the end. Didn't have to lead the Fukuda Task Force, which was actually just, I think, one or two jeeps going from the last place in northern Italy that we went to. They drove all the way up to the Swiss border. He very well could have been shot by a sniper or something. a Korean American who was our battalion intelligence officer. They were aware of the friction between Koreans and Japan.
Yeah.
So they gave him also the option. Of course, he says, I grew up in Los Angeles. My father had a grocery store there. I have a lot of Japanese-American friends. That makes no difference to me. He gained a lot of respect. When the 100th Battalion was Anzio, they needed information. He crawled on his belly and took two non-coms with him, crawled on his belly all night and grabbed a couple of German prisoners and made them crawl all the way back, and they got information.
Sounds like those guys set a pretty powerful example.
He did.
Were you excited to come home?
Oh, absolutely. Even though it was a slow ship, I went over on the Queen Mary, which was a fast ship.
Yeah.
Came home on a Victory ship, which was a slow ship. But we were bringing home the regimental colors in the summertime, sleep on the deck at night, ice cream every night.
Hey, hey.
Movies. When we hit New York Harbor, because it was a big celebration that the city of New York and the Army put on for us, welcoming the regiment home, big to-do in New York Harbor, and then preparing to march in Washington, D.C.
What was that like?
I think we drilled for almost 2 weeks at Fort Belvoir, Virginia, across the Potomac from D.C., got new uniforms and everything. And then they went over to D.C. and it was a rainy day, but the story goes that asked Truman, he said, in light of the weather, you want to cancel, and he says, no. He supposedly said, what these boys been through, what's a little rain? So He came out of the White House to the Ellipse, which is a oval-shaped area across from the White House, and we passed in review, and he had a rain trench coat on and pinned the presidential unit citation on our regimental colors and welcomed us home.
Quite the contrast from being told you're 4C.
Well, it is. Thinking back makes you wonder. Roosevelt, I don't think, really knew the character of the Americans of Japanese ancestry that lived in this country. He was born and raised in New York, and I don't think there are very many Japanese back there.
I've noticed a few times now that every time you refer to it, you use the verbiage, Americans of Japanese ancestry. You don't want a hyphen in there anywhere.
No.
Why is that?
I've been approached by a number of people, and because of my facial features and stuff, they say, are you Japanese? I know what they mean.
Right.
But I make it a point to say, no, I'm an American. Not to embarrass them, but what they have to realize is that America is made up of all different ethnic groups. And I'm an American. I just happen to be an American of Japanese ancestry.
And when you are in front of the White House with the President of the United States pinning the highest honor he can give to a unit on your unit colors, I guess you guys proved how American you were.
Never occurred to me.
And you said something to me. You'd be eligible for a Bronze Star for having been a combat soldier in Europe. You'd be eligible for a medal from the French government for helping to liberate that country. And you have not taken advantage of those opportunities. And you told me that the things that mean the most to you are that PUC, that Presidential Unit Citation, and your Combat Infantry Badge. Why? Why do those two decorations give you pride?
I've seen too many guys who deserve more than they got. One of the things that when I went over and we're in our off times, we'd talk about it, and the guys would say, well, so-and-so should have gotten a Medal of Honor. He didn't. He got a Distinguished Service Cross instead. And it said, all in how you write it up. And apparently, our higher-ups didn't know how to exactly write up a citation. That was part of it, and probably a lesser part than the fact that they weren't about to give a Congressional Medal of Honor to. There was even controversy about giving a Congressional Medal of Honor to Munimori.
Well, and the thing that backs that up is what President Clinton did in the 90s,
yeah,
which was upgrade some of those Distinguished Service Crosses to Medals of Honor for guys like your friend Joe Sakato here in Denver.
So I told my son and my family, they, why didn't you apply for those? Medals don't mean that much to me.
I do want to ask you about one other medal, though, because this was in the last decade here. 60 years after the war, they say the Congressional Gold Medal goes to all
Nisei veterans.
And my son, I wasn't even going to go to that. But my family insisted I go, and they said, well, you need an escort. I said, I could do it myself. My son said, oh, I'd like to go anyway. So we went, and we were there for the ceremony.
What did that mean to you, that the Congress of the United States is singling you out as saying, you did something worth celebrating?
It meant a lot to me that we were getting the recognition that we deserved. On the other hand, we're sitting back there several rows back, and the politicians are sitting in front of us. And I told my son, I said, where were they when we needed them? But it was good because Danny Noe gave a nice speech.
I was going to say, he's the one politician you couldn't blame because he's a Medal
right.
of Honor winner.
Yeah.
Well, I don't want to forget to say something important. Thank you. Thank you for serving our country, and thank you for telling us this story from your perspective. When it comes to the Americans of Japanese ancestry who served our country during World War II, what gives you the most pride, and what do you think is the biggest thing that the rest of us who weren't around then need to know and remember?
I'm glad I served. My feeling is it opened the doors for the rest of our children. They're doing things that we wouldn't even think of doing now. So it's life is easier, even though I know that they face discrimination once in a while. So I think we opened a lot of doors. That was because the Nisei soldiers did a good job. The guys in the MIS did a good job. The other thing is I want to make sure that this story is told over and over again. Something like the Jewish Holocaust. If you don't talk about it, they're going to forget.
And it could happen again.
It could happen again. The fact that I let you interview me and the fact that I've been interviewed before, and it's because I want the rest of the America to know what we did during the war, that we're Americans just like anyone else that was born here, even though we look different.
Amen. And when you say you opened a lot of doors, tell me if I'm wrong when I say this. Aren't some of the other doors that you opened the gates to those internment camps? Even though you never had to spend time in them, what you guys did overseas made it impossible for the government to ignore and really force their hand in releasing those people who had been wrongly imprisoned.
Yeah.
And you told us about some of your close calls there overseas. If those go a little differently, you don't come back, you don't go to pharmacy school and become a pharmacist, you don't meet your wife, your son's never born. You ever think about that?
I don't know. Maybe I did. I don't know. I guess going to the monument and looking at that, my name could be on the front end of that monument. But I'm lucky. Even now in peacetime, I'm blessed. 92 years old and still able to cook for myself, still able to drive.
What would you say you're most thankful for, Sam?
That I have a good family. Thankful that I'm blessed the way I am.
And we are blessed to know you. Sam Terasaki, 92 years old. I hope you took his words to heart today, as I'm going to try to. Find photos of Sam at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. And join us again next time when we're reminded once more through the stories of our veterans that freedom is not free.